criminals are now being deployed against peaceful protesters and activists. Matteo Gargiulo, a policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, told The Intercept that the fact there is a Marshall Service drone program at all is indicative of how thoroughly crime-fighting agencies in the United States now resemble war-fighting forces. The Marshall Service has drones for much the same reason that many local police departments have tanks, he said. The slow militarization of local and federal law enforcement as a result on the war on crime, war on drugs, and war on terror have created dozens of desperate law enforcement agencies with advanced technology and bloated budgets, he added. The mere knowledge that the drone is or even could be watching demonstrators threatens to chill out right to protest. Stanley also objected to the near full redaction of the flight emails, which the Marshall Service argued was warranted on the basis that they would reveal secret investigative techniques and could reasonably be expected to endanger the life or physical safety of any individual. But, as Stanley pointed out, it's not as if flying a camera-packing drone over a throng of people is a new or secret technique in the year 2021. How high are the chances they use their drones in some clever, innovative way they need to keep secret because nobody else has thought of it, he explained. No matter how they are using it, the Marshall Service needs to be open and transparent given the relative novelty of drones as a law enforcement surveillance tool and their significant implications for our privacy. This kind of reflexively secretive behavior is one reason activists and communities tend not to give agencies the benefit of the doubt when they seek new surveillance technologies.
The Israeli violation of the rights of Palestinians does not seem to abate. In the latest development, the regime fully closed Gaza's fishing zone, preventing Palestinians from sailing off the besieged enclave. Israeli authorities said the total closure was in response to rocket attacks from the Gaza Strip. They said five rockets were fired from Gaza at Israel overnight. But the decision comes as fishing is a significant source of income for many Gazans. The size of the fishing zone has varied over the years. It was set at 20 nautical miles by the Oslo Peace Accords in the 1990s before being reduced to 6 miles under the joint Israeli-Egyptian blockade in 2007. This, as a measure, is not enough for doing any fishing in the first place. But the Israeli regime has raised and lowered the limit several times in recent years in a bid to pressure the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas.
Israeli policy towards Gazans and their fishing industry has long been part of their plan to periodically crush Gazans and to keep the economy on life supports. I think we also have to look at the current situation in the framing of what's going on in Israel, that there is recently been an election, that Netanyahu is trying to put together a group of cohorts that will create a majority in the Knesset, and that he will often create military issues or heighten military tensions in order to increase his popularity and to get people to rally around him. So I think it's a combination of their longstanding policies and the current situation in the electorate in Israel.
The decision to fully shut the fishing zone to the Palestinians comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called for the military to prepare for any scenario regarding the Gaza Strip. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz also echoed Netanyahu's remarks, saying Israeli forces will do whatever necessary to quote, preserve calm. Israel's closure of the fishing zone limits what little the blockaded territory has for its food supplies. According to figures, there are some 4,000 fishermen registered in the Gaza Strip who are breadwinners of some 50,000 people. This, however, is something misleading as half of those registered are actually out of work. 95% of Gaza fishermen population lives under the poverty line. Many of them rely on humanitarian aid and belong to the 80% of Gaza's overall population who rely on such aid. But the closure of the fishing zone is not the only nightmare the Palestinians live with. The Israeli regime has put nearly 3 million people under a tight land, sea, and air blockade since 2007, bringing almost the entire population to starvation. The blockade targets Gaza's vital infrastructure, including water, energy, health, and other sectors, complicating the already dire humanitarian situation there. Gaza's health sector, for instance, is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies. Many believe this is itself a war crime in its own form and must be stopped.
So the issue of whether the behavior of the Israeli government and military comprise various war crimes is one that has been debated and exposed repeatedly. And there are now questions in front of the International Criminal Court. And I think that they will obviously come up with an opinion themselves. Personally, I find much of the behavior of the Israeli government and the military towards the 2.2 million Gazans can be characterized as various kinds of war crimes.
Meanwhile, the blockade has exacerbated further with COVID-19 ravaging the Gaza Strip. This brings to the spotlight the fact that the blockade and sufferings of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are going unnoticed.
Well, the Gazans have long been invisible on the world stage. Many of us have tried to highlight the exacerbations of the humanitarian catastrophe in view of the COVID-19 pandemic. But it's part of a longstanding pattern of valuing Jewish-Israeli lives over the lives of Palestinians living in Gaza. And I think this is a combination of both medical apartheid and racism and Islamophobia and forces like that that shape international opinion.
What is questionable, however, is that the international community must have a role in bringing Palestinian sufferings to an end, and humanitarian efforts must gain momentum to get the blockade lifted. This includes international legal bodies like the International Criminal Court, which can play a key role in calling Israel to account over its decades-long crimes against the Palestinian people.
The deadly and highly contagious novel coronavirus has had a huge impact on billions of people's lives, weighing down on the economy, putting workers out of work around the globe, and more. After gaining an understanding of the virus, countries around the world began developing their versions of a COVID-19 vaccine.
It's called Operation Warp Speed. That means big and it means fast. A massive scientific, industrial, and logistical endeavor unlike anything our country has seen since the Manhattan Project.
The United States, under former President Donald Trump, launched a vaccine program dubbed Operation Warp Speed and invested heavily in producing, delivering, and distributing the jabs. The program proved successful, and the country produced different vaccines for the disease. But under patent-related restrictions, it prevented other nations from having access to the know-how to produce life-saving vaccines at home. With Donald Trump gone, President Joe Biden is now facing increasing pressure to issue a waiver for the restrictions. Several Democratic leaders, including Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, have joined a petition with 2 million signatures demanding that the U.S. administration drop its support of a World Trade Organization agreement that bars other countries from accessing the patents. Charity organization Oxfam has called the current situation of the distribution of jabs in the world as vaccine apartheid, noting that the world is dealing with a public health emergency and that the pandemic isn't a private profit opportunity.
The fact that the U.S. does not want to remove a patent on some of its key vaccine developments against COVID-19 is another symbol of how this empire is ruled by profits, by money, by the pursuit of wealth against everything else. It doesn't care about human life. It doesn't care about human beings and their health and prosperity. It cares about money because the United States worships money. Its God is money. And it's something that's horrible to understand because we're in the middle of overcoming a pandemic that is still very much a threat to a lot of people around the world.
The comments come ahead of shareholder meetings for the giant pharmaceutical company. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, peoples in the United States have received approximately a quarter of total vaccines administered around the globe. Other wealthier nations in the world have also received significantly higher numbers of vaccines compared to middle and low-income countries. A Washington Post report indicates the United States will have an oversupply of hundreds of millions of coronavirus vaccine doses as soon as July. The figure has raised concerns about possible hoarding in the country. Earlier this month, Amnesty International condemned richer countries for failing a, quote, rudimentary test of global solidarity by hoarding COVID vaccines, accusing them of exploiting the pandemic to undermine human rights. Also, the World Health Organization warned richer countries that their deals with big pharmaceutical companies will hurt the global COVAX program for poorer nations. The UN agency says its plan to roll out 1.3 billion doses of vaccine to low and middle-income nations by the end of this year has been slow, as wealthier nations are approaching vaccine manufacturers that the COVAX program is counting on.
We can't expect these big countries like the United States, like the United Kingdom, to save us, because they haven't, and we're seeing that happen as we speak. We're seeing these first world developed countries hoard access to medicine and vaccines that can potentially save the lives of millions of people around the world. And the only way we're going to get around this is developing the means of production, developing infrastructure, doing what Iran is doing, what China is doing, what Venezuela and Cuba and Russia and others are doing, and creating pharmaceutical industries that are not dependent on Pfizer, not dependent on Moderna, not dependent on Johnson & Johnson, but are shared technologies by all people around the world.
We are in the middle of a pandemic that has spread to every country in the world. Unless all the Earth's 8 billion inhabitants are vaccinated, the novel coronavirus is expected to stay with us for much longer.
The occupied city of Jerusalem al-Quds has seen regular clashes over the past week between Palestinian residents and Israeli military forces who have been blocking Palestinians from sitting on the steps of Damascus Gate. This is while thousands of Palestinians traditionally sit in the area following nighttime prayers during the holy Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. On Thursday, the Israeli regime forces attacked Palestinians who gathered outside of the Damascus Gate on the north side of the occupied old city of Jerusalem al-Quds. That ignited protests against restrictions on their Palestinians' gatherings in Jerusalem al-Quds' old city during the fasting month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians were injured at the Damascus Gate of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds as Palestinian activists confronted hundreds of far-right and extremist Israeli settlers chanting death to Arabs in their rally in the center of the occupied city. Palestinian protesters, angered by chants of death to Arabs from far-right Jewish demonstrators, clashed repeatedly with Israeli police. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said in a statement that at least 105 Palestinians were injured, including 22 people who were hospitalized. Also, Israeli forces arrested at least 50 Palestinians during the clashes. The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas denounced the violence against Palestinians, saying that he holds the Israeli regime accountable for this serious deterioration. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has denounced Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Jerusalem outlets, expressing its solidarity with the victims. Meanwhile, dozens of rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip towards Israel in alliance with protesters in outlets. Israeli media said that the Palestinian resistance movement fired 36 rockets toward the occupied territories. Israeli authorities claimed that most of the rockets had struck open areas, while only six of the projectiles had been intercepted by the Iron Dome missile defense system. Israel responded by carrying out airstrikes across the besieged coastal sliver.
I think what's going on is that there has been a continuation of violence, state violence, by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinians, against the indigenous people. And it is the latest chapter, if you like, of what's actually been going on in terms of that. And this idea of the Zionists trying to take over that land, take over that place, is something that is continuing unabated. And it is something that needs to be recognized for what it is that they are actually doing.
Israel lays claim to the entire Jerusalem outlets, but the international community views the city's eastern sector as occupied territory, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state. According to the UN Security Council Resolution 478, other member states are prohibited from establishing diplomatic missions in Jerusalem outlets. The resolution states that the Council does not recognize Jerusalem outlets as the occupying Israeli regime's capital. Palestinians who seek an independent state in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, with East Jerusalem outlets as its capital, have condemned the U.S. pro-Israel agenda. During the former U.S. President Donald Trump, Israel stepped up its settlement expansion in defiance of the UN Security Council Resolution 2334. According to the resolution, settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets are illegal. Also, several countries, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, normalized their relations with the Israeli regime by signing the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets. All of them are illegal under international law, for they were built on occupied land.
Unless there is a reality check and unless there is something done to recognize the oppression that the Israelis are carrying out on that occupied land, nothing is going to change. There is going to be no peace without justice being served.
Israel has made it a priority to change the demographics of Jerusalem outlets and Judaize the city slowly but surely. While Palestinians are the rightful owners of Jerusalem outlets and the international community is against the Israeli regime's illegal settlements, there have not been any moves to stop Israel from advancing his plans.
From drones to missiles, Iran's been enhancing its military and defense capabilities by employing and testing homegrown state-of-the-art technologies. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently released footage portraying the country's latest advancements in the field of drone technology. The footage captured by IRGC drones shows close-up shots of an American aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. The Defense Force also released a video that shows its kamikaze drones hitting their targets with surgical accuracy. Meanwhile, the head of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees the American forces stationed in the West Asia region, revealed to the U.S. Congress that Iranian drone power has stripped the American Air Force of what the commander called its upper hand in the world. General McKenzie made the comments in written testimony to the House Armed Services Committee, in which he noted how Washington was daunted by Iran's far and wide application of small and medium-sized drones for surveillance and attacks. The top general said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region.
This is something that is going to be very troubling to U.S. government officials because they certainly don't want anybody to have major power except for themselves and some of their allies, such as Israel in the Middle East. But as far as the U.S. finally conceding that its power is limited, It's going to take a long time for them to actually recognize that, to face that reality. They're going to work hard to overcome it, spending more money than they already spend on the military. And right now, the U.S. spends more on its military than the next 10 nations combined. So it's going to be another kind of arms race, and it will not have a good outcome at all. But hopefully the United States will at some point turn its attentions elsewhere into some other area, either of the world or looking more closely at its own internal problems.
Iran's military says the capabilities have enabled it to nip any security threat in the bud.
I am announcing today that we...
Tensions between Iran and the United States escalated after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew Washington from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign, reinstating sanctions against Tehran and ramping up its military presence in the West Asia region. What happened following the move has been regarded as a test of strength for Iran, not only economically, but also militarily. One instance proving Iran's military advancements occurred on June 20, 2019, when Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps shot down an intruding United States RQ-4A Global Hawk spying drone with a surface-to-air missile over the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has repeatedly said its military capabilities are merely for the defensive purposes and has called for regional cooperation to ensure peace in the Persian Gulf region. In this regard, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani presented a plan dubbed the Hormuz Peace Initiative, or HOPE, which aims at establishing long-term peace in the region, an issue that Iran says is impossible as long as outsiders are present.
This will happen eventually. More and more nations will see that they can rely on Iran. Iran has the strength, Iran has the will, and Iran is looking for peace in the Middle East. The United States is not looking for peace in the Middle East. It has no interest in peace in the Middle East, which is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, why the Iranian government will not work with the United States. Iran is a force to be reckoned with, and the United States has just recognized that in a major way.
But what does the U.S. recognition of Iran's military power amid its waning presence in the region mean for Washington? Only time can tell.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight. Because the signs of U.S. capitalism's decline are denied or misunderstood, they lead individuals and groups often to resort to frustrated, misguided, and desperate acts. They are blind to the structural problem of an economic system no longer capable of dealing with its contradictions. We now present you an article written by Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. The piece is titled Increasing Desperation as U.S. Capitalist System Declines. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Richard Wolff's article. Like all previous economic systems in recorded history, capitalism is on track to repeat the same three-step trip: birth, evolution, and death. The timing and other specifics of each system's trip differs. Births and evolutions are commonly experienced as positive, celebrated for their progress and promise. However, the declines and deaths are often denied and usually feel difficult and depressing. U.S. capitalism has reached and passed its peak. Like that of the British Empire after the First World War, the trip now is painful. Signs of decline accumulate. The last 40 years of slow economic growth in the United States have seen the top 10% take nearly all of it. The other 90% of the population suffered constricted real wage growth, and that drove them to borrow massively for homes, cars, credit cards, and college expenses. Of course, their creditors were mostly that same 10%. University costs rose as graduates' prospects for good jobs and incomes fell. Those without degrees faced worse prospects. Inequalities of wealth and income soared. To protect their position atop these inequalities, the 10% increased their donation-fueled sway over politics and culture. Compliant politicians then reinforced the deepening inequalities of wealth and income in that typical spiral of systems in decline. The U.S. response to COVID-19 displays more signs. With 4% of the world's population, the United States accounts for 20% of the world's COVID-19 deaths. Despite being a rich country with so-called well-developed medical apparatus, the system as a whole has failed to cope. Its response compares unfavorably with that of many less rich, less medically equipped nations. In the United States, testing, prevention, treatment, and vaccination remain uneven, inadequate, and slow. The United States has recent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were neither necessary nor successful in military terms. They did enable massive government spending and justified rising defense outlays in federal budgets. Huge U.S. military spending also helped cause neglect of infrastructure maintenance. That has now become urgent. The old guns versus butter problem typically attends economic system declines. As the U.S. government tries desperately to manage the mushrooming costs of its foreign and domestic programs, it resorts to a modern version of the ancients' debasing of the coinage. The Federal Reserve System monetizes deficits in fast-growing magnitudes. Given unemployment, constricted wages, and excessive personal debt levels, the money creation does not flow into real investment, but rather into stock markets. Inflation there has thus been real, fueling ever-deepening wealth inequality. We get promises that money creation will never shift its focus onto goods and services, thereby provoking classic inflation. We get assurances that the U.S. Federal Reserve will register and control such an inflation if it threatens. Those promises and assurances aim to help prevent what those in charge know are terrifying possibilities. The 6th of January assault on the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. made a shocked nation more aware of how deep its social divisions have become and how its social cohesion has disintegrated. Those who attacked the Capitol building reacted to the decline of capitalism by desperate resistance to an election result, to political liberalism, to multiculturalism, and so on and so forth. Like Donald Trump, they tried to reverse capitalism's decline because their ideology precludes them from recognizing that decline. They reason otherwise. They blame and therefore seek to dismantle the government itself. Yet the U.S. government, via the two-party oligopoly in the U.S. politics, has single-mindedly supported U.S. capitalism. The two political parties differ partly and only on how best to do that. As decline persists, despite the party's efforts to stop it, building frustration eventually boils over. Efforts become extreme and thereby worsen rather than solve the problem. Donald Trump's cabinet members often devoted themselves to destroying their respective departments. The January 6th attackers sought to destroy as well. Such self-destruction is a sign of advanced system decline. Throwing money now at the long-neglected U.S. infrastructure runs a risk of failure parallel to what happened to U.S. foreign aid and many U.S. military adventures. The federal spending involved always goes either to private corporations for contracted goods and services, or else it goes to governments, foreign or domestic, local, regional or national. The recipient governments likewise use them for contracts with private corporations. For example, large private corporations will carry out most of the work of U.S. infrastructure repair and updating. The contracted corporations will in turn use the money paid to them just as they use all their revenues from all of their other contracts. Some of the money will go to employees' wages and salaries, but much of it will go to all the other normal costs of doing business. These include high salaries for middle management and luxurious pay packages for upper management, machines for automation, relocating facilities from higher wage areas to lower wage areas to enhance profits, dividend increases for shareholders, interest on and repayment of corporate loans, and fees paid to outside consultants hired to help plan corporate growth, overseas investments, and defeating union drives. In short, federal spending will flow into corporate hands that will then reproduce the very system that neglected infrastructure and deepened income and wealth inequalities over recent decades. The system's decline is reproduced because its leaders cannot see the internal production structure of U.S. capitalism as a central problem, let alone to change it. U.S. factories, offices and stores are nearly all divided into a dominant minority of owners and boards of directors versus a dominated majority of employees. That structure is deeply undemocratic. Employers are not accountable to employees. They use their position to enrich themselves relative to their employees, increasingly so over the last half century. The minority's unstable investment decisions, driven by irreducible uncertainty and what John Maynard Keynes, an English economist, called animal spirits, impose recurring, costly business cycles on society. The tensions and antagonisms between employers and employees upset and undermine physical and mental health and the vaunted efficiency of the system at every turn. because the signs of U.S. capitalism's decline are denied or misunderstood, they lead individuals and groups often to resort to frustrated, misguided, and desperate acts. They are blind to the structural problem of an economic system no longer capable of dealing with its contradictions. Thus, the economic decline accelerates, like a train rushing down a track towards a stone wall. Most of its conductors and passengers either see no signs, or else note them but without connecting them to their basic problem: being on a moving train on track to hit a stone wall.
Around the World with Reporters.
Amid the continued advancement of the Yemeni army in the city of Marib, the Saudi-led coalition has begun to build new military camps in Shabwand al-Wadi'a areas to deploy more troops in the city.
What the Saudi-led coalition has in mind by building new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas shows that the coalition is losing the control of Marib. It is now desperately trying to keep the city under its control, but the Yemeni army is determined to liberate all Yemeni lands.
The latest measures by Saudi-led coalition in Marib comes after Yemeni army backed by allied fighters from popular committees took control of strategic areas, including Tum al-Ulya Hill, which is 4 kilometers away from the western neighborhoods of the city of Marib.
Al-Tuma al-Ulya Hill has a great military and strategic importance as it can provide Yemeni army with a good opportunity to achieve its military goals. The hill overlooks the city of Marib, so the Yemeni army will be able to target the enemy inside the city.
The Yemeni army has also intensified its retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Earlier, Yemeni troops launched an attack with a drone of Qasif K2 against King Khalid Airbase in Asir in Britain. Retaliation for the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Yemenis say their army will continue its operations to liberate all the Yemeni lands, including the oil-rich province of Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Turkey vowed to respond duly to U.S. President Joe Biden's recognition of the events of 1915 as a genocide. Back on Saturday, Joe Biden said the U.S. honors the victims of the Metzjagern so that the horrors of what happened were never lost to history. He became the first U.S. president to officially recognize the alleged Armenian genocide. Immediately after Biden's declaration, Turkey's foreign ministry denounced him in strongest terms, saying the move does not have a scholarly and legal basis, nor is it supported by any evidence. The ministry also summoned the U.S. ambassador to Ankara to voice its protest against Washington. Meanwhile, Turkish defense minister said that the declaration by the U.S. president may disrupt peace in the region.
Historical events should not be used as a tool of conflict and setting an account. They should not be politicized. It is clear that such an environment will negatively affect ties between Turkey and Armenia, Turks and Armenians, as well as regional peace. It should be known that history cannot be rewritten through such political statements.
Relations between Turkey and U.S. have been in trouble, especially after U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey for purchasing Russian-made S-400 missiles. Ankara is also still angry at Washington for supporting and aiding Kurdish militants in Syria, which Turkey considers as terrorists. This statement is seen by many as an addition to the pile of tensions between the two NATO allies.
I think the declaration by the U.S. President Biden will create further tensions between Ankara and Washington. The declaration is not legally binding. Turkey has always said it's ready to open its archive for evidence. However, the use of this card every now and then by Washington will create a strategic row between the two NATO allies.
Since Saturday, protests were held in front of the U.S. consulate in Istanbul, with demonstrators denouncing the statement and calling on Ankara to cut ties with Washington. Turkey often lodges a formal complaint when foreign governments describe the tragic wartime events in Ottoman Turkey as genocide. Ankara maintains that many people on both sides of the conflict lost their lives. It also proposed to the Armenian side on 2005 the establishment of a joint history commission to reach a just conclusion about the historical facts of that period. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Given the prevailing poverty in Afghanistan, active charities and relief organizations in the country normally increase their support to the most vulnerable people, mainly widows, orphans and jobless people, during the holy month of Ramadan. Imam Khomeini Relief Committee is one of the most active charity organizations in Afghanistan that has provided many services to Afghans, especially to poor families, since its establishment in Afghanistan at least two decades ago. Representatives of the Relief Committee of Imam Khomeini and Iranian Embassy in Kabul attended this iftari program at one of Kabul's orphanages as a show of support and respect to the culture of helping poor ones.
We view all Muslim countries, particularly Afghanistan, as our brothers. We look to them as our own people. Iran and Afghanistan enjoy too much commonalities in terms of cultural, religion, society, and many other fields. That is why we proudly do whatever in our power to help them.
The participation of the delegation of Iranian embassy in Kabul in events like this is usually welcomed by Afghans.
Iran is our neighbor and an Islamic country. We consider it as a brother nation who has always supported us in different fields such as culture, economy, politics, and social affairs, especially since the war began in Afghanistan.
As observers say, Iran is one of greatest supporters of Afghanistan that has extensively backed the people and governments of Afghanistan since decades ago. Currently, Tehran plays a key role in Afghanistan and is supporting Kabul's policies, especially in terms of bringing peace to the war-ravaged country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The EU's controversial border and coast guard agency Frontex is on course to receive greater power to deport up to 500,000 refugees who have had their applications for asylum in the EU rejected. Frontex is under investigation over allegations that it has aggressively pushed back refugees trying to reach the 27-country bloc.
The European agency always have to comply with fundamental rights. And I don't think that it's right to accuse that Frontex is not doing that. And if there are shortcomings in Frontex, they have to be addressed.
The European Commission has just launched its so-called voluntary return and reintegration strategy. The European Trade Union Confederation and several rights groups say it's all about border control, deterrence, detention and deportation of refugees.
Let's have a common asylum policy between EU member states, put it into practice, and then we see where we are. Certainly, this is not going to stop.
Just last week, 130 refugees drowned after their dinghy capsized in the Mediterranean as they attempted to reach the EU. Frontex vessels didn't get to the scene on time. The situation is not good for those who do make it to the bloc. More than 20,000 refugees are currently trapped on Greek and Spanish islands.
Those include children, pregnant women, and people with mental health problems. They are surviving in trailers and tents and have limited access to essential services, including water.
EU countries have made it clear they don't want to house refugees. Denmark is pushing ahead with plans to deport Syrians back to their war-torn country. Rights groups say this is astonishing given the role the West played in practically destroying the Arab Republic. Aid agencies say the EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and African countries to prevent refugees from trying to seek asylum here. This as the EU is being forced to defend the actions of its own agencies.
We will not accept this Frontex bashing that comes so cheap.
Rights groups say the EU continues to breach the 1951 UN Refugee Convention, which obliges the bloc to protect asylum seekers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following another meeting with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal in Vienna, Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still big challenges ahead. As diplomatic attempts continue to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, the main problem is still who should come back first, Iran or the US.
The problem or the challenge is about the sequence of who should come first, who should come first to full compliance and full implementation of its commitments. On that, obviously, there are still differences. Our position is quite clear, and we are not going to change that.
Russia and China support Iran's demand that the U.S. remove sanctions in a verifiable manner first.
We believe it is the U.S. previous administration who first pulled out from the JCPOA. So it's just axiomatic that U.S. should abolish all its unilateral sanctions against Iran, as well as any third party in the first place, before Iran move to implement the provisions on the JCPOA accordingly. So this is a fundamental issue involving rights versus wrong.
There are also serious differences on which sanctions the US should remove.
Our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA, and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration.
Up until now, two working groups have been trying to come up with a final list of US sanctions that need removing and nuclear measures that need to be taken by Iran. From Wednesday, a third working group will begin discussions on timetables and sequence, as well as ways to verify sanctions lifting. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
For the fifth consecutive day, India has recorded an overwhelming number of COVID-19 infections. The country lodged around 350,000 fresh cases and about 2,700 deaths, raising fears of further devastation and dismay among its citizens. Many experts say the numbers are underestimations and that the real figures are likely to be much higher than the government figures. By Sunday, the number of total cases in the world's second most populous nation stood at 17 million with over 192,000 deaths.
India is witnessing scenes of utter mayhem amid a new wave of the outbreak. The hospitals have been overwhelmed and are turning away patients due to lack of beds and oxygen supplies, revealing the vulnerability of India's healthcare system.
Many Indian states have now imposed more stringent restrictions on people's movement. Here in the capital, New Delhi, the lockdown has been extended for one more week as the cases are soaring rapidly. According to some estimations, more than 300 people are infected with COVID-19 every minute across the country. A few months ago, India seemed to be doing remarkably well in handling the COVID crisis, but experts say election campaigns, gatherings, and opening up of markets and public spaces aggravated the situation.
What we see on the TV about government data on deaths or infection is nothing but just a glimpse of actual numbers. Many cases are not even being reported, nor the calculations are accurate. This is not a pandemic. This is the sign of the judgment day. We don't even have a calculation of how many we cremate each day.
In his latest radio telecast, Prime Minister Narendra Modi urged the nation not to fall prey to rumors and assured that the free vaccination program will continue in full swing. Indian leaders said this storm has shaken the country. Leaders from across the globe have expressed their concern and extended support in every possible way. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Senior officials from all signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are in the Austrian capital, Vienna, discussing ways to revive the ailing accord. 3 weeks on, there's no tangible progress in the discussions. Iran's top negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, said if Iran feels the other parties are trying to buy time, Tehran will leave the talks.
We are not here to waste our time. We are not here to negotiate for negotiations. We are here to specify and identify the sanctions which should be lifted by the U.S.
In his weekly briefing, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, said there will be no agreement without an all-inclusive agreement.
We are not interested in lengthy talks, but we are also not in rush. The only principle that we are following is to fulfill all the benefits that Iran is supposed to get out of the JCPOA. Anything less than a wholesale, verifiable, and a single step removal of all sanctions is not accepted by Tehran.
The Vienna talks have so far failed to lead to concrete results. The major sticking point is the fact that the U.S. insists on pushing its own narrative, pressing for a step-for-step removal of the sanctions. Tehran has categorically rejected such a plan in the first place, saying Washington needs to verifiably remove all sanctions before Iran returns to full compliance.
All the sanctions, including those who have been imposed, reimposed, or relabeled, should be removed. The domestic politics of the United States is not our concern. In international relations and international law, governments are sole responsible bodies to fulfill the commitments of the states when they make.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. As a tit-for-tat, Iran reduced its own commitments by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, above the 3.6% cap set by the deal. As the Vienna discussions are becoming sluggish, Tehran says there's no need for prolonged negotiations. Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must lift all anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Period. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Many artists across the world have turned to art to show the suffering of the Palestinian people. They use art as a medium of expression against the Israeli regime's repressive policies. Iran's Art Bureau of the Islamic Ideology Dissemination Organization is currently holding an exhibition and competition called Palestine is Not Alone. Hundreds of works by different artists from many countries are displayed at this international cartoon and poster contest, which is held to show solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine.
We received around 2,500 works from 66 countries. Salient figures sent cartoons, caricatures, and posters to participate in the contest. It shows that there are many artists across the globe who want to support the oppressed people of Palestine and stand against the oppressor.
Today's war has a new form. It is more staged in the media. Art as a medium is now playing an important role in wars. There are many people who do not want to comment directly on war. Therefore, they prefer artistic ways to express themselves.
I Free You Palestine and Lullaby were two poems by Atefe Sadat Darbandi, which were later turned into a video clip. The clips have been screened on Press TV and welcomed by the audience.
I was feeling sad when seeing the photos of the Palestinian kids who were suffering in conflicts, so I wrote an English poem called Lullaby for these kids. It is a story of the parents who are singing lullaby for their babies, asking them to keep calm because all these difficulties may pass. A colleague of mine composed its music and sang the song. Then we turned it into a video clip to be aired on TV.
The issue of Palestine is one of the major topics these days when deals are being formed between some Arab states and Israel to normalize ties. But artists from these countries oppose such relations.
Resistance art reflects how the Palestinians suffered under occupation for over 50 years. Art is a great way of expression and helps the artists to show their first-hand experiences. Humana Abedi, Tehran.
The Palestinian Authority, along with different political factions, held Israel fully responsible for the serious deterioration in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds over the past few days and called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its provocations. Israeli police and settler violence erupted in the area on Thursday night and continued through Friday, leaving over 100 of Palestinians wounded and scores more arrested.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, Israeli forces had been escalating measures against the people there, starting by cutting off loudspeakers of Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's why our people in Al-Quds are protesting and rising against oppression and crimes by the Israeli regime.
But the issue is not only between the Israeli police and the Palestinians. Since the start of the holy month of Ramadan, every night hundreds of Israeli settlers rush to the streets of the holy city and assault Palestinians under the protection of the Israeli forces. The extremist settlers chant death to Arabs during their marches. Hundreds of ultra-nationalist Israelis marched through central Jerusalem towards the Damascus Gate, which police had barricaded as a precaution.
Verbal condemnation of Israel over the aggression is not enough. The Palestinian factions must offer all forms of support to Al-Quds and its residents. Palestinians must stand united behind Al-Quds. What's going on is an uprising, and here in occupied West Bank, protests and demonstrations should continue. This is the least we can do to defend Al-Quds.
Palestinians say Israeli police want to prevent them from saying their prayers and the usual Ramadan evening gatherings at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and outside the Damascus Gate.
Protests which flared up in Jerusalem Al-Quds have now spilled over to the occupied West Bank in defense of the Holy City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians warned that Tel Aviv is heading towards a heavy-handed crackdown against them in the occupied territories to ward off another surge in Palestinians' protests and anger. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Nowadays, Afghan security and military forces are witnessing the last months of the presence of their US-led NATO allies. These forces are determined to protect their country against any threats on their own without any outside help. As top military officials here say, the Afghan armed forces will overcome any challenges after the pullout of foreign troops by drawing on the experience they have gained in fighting terrorism over the past two decades.
Currently, US-led NATO forces are stationed in their bases only in Bagram and Balkh provinces, but they will leave these key bases too. We won't be worried about this because our forces have, over the past two decades, gained enough experience on how to counter terrorists.
Confirming that Afghan military and security forces are still in need of financial support, the Afghan government says the good news is that foreign forces will hand over military hardware to the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country by September 11.
Based on our negotiations with foreign military officials, they will hand over weapons and other military equipment worth $1 billion to Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country.
According to experts here, because the Afghan National Armed Forces are popular among locals, Afghan people are expected to stand by these troops and support any possible scenario that might unfold after the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. Still, they urge both the Afghan government and the Taliban to set aside their differences and use the Afghan peace process as a great opportunity to put an end to the decades-long misery of the war-weary nation.
Unfortunately, we have gained nothing from peace summits over the past 2 years. Instead, war in the country has intensified. I think it is high time that both sides forgot about military options, set aside their differences, and launched meaningful negotiations to end the war here.
Top Afghan security officials say they stand ready to safeguard the nation in case the Taliban continue to insist on saying no to negotiations.
According to the head of Afghanistan's National Directorate of Security, the Taliban is now weaker than ever due to alleged rifts between the militant group's main leadership in Quetta Shura and its offshoot in Pakistan's Peshawar. This is thought to be a major stumbling block if the militants seek to put up a fight against some 300,000 Afghan security and defense forces after the withdrawal of nearly 10,000 foreign troops from Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please